This Father's Day at Lowe's, score free gifts for the greatest dad. Right now, get a free select DeWalt, Craftsman, or Kobalt tool with purchase of a select battery kit. Plus, get a free Werner 2-foot aluminum ladder when you buy an 8-foot fiberglass ladder. Shop these deals and more this Father's Day at Lowe's. We help, you save. Valid through 6/15 while supplies last. Selection varies by location.
In 2006, a teenage girl was abducted in South Carolina. As her family, the police, and volunteers were searching, she would be kept underground at the mercy of a dangerous sexual predator, and she'd be left to orchestrate her own escape. This is the incredible story of a survivor like no other. This is the abduction of Elizabeth Schoaf. I'm Emma Kenny, welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. I heard about this story when I saw some interviews of the young woman it affected, and it was mind-blowing, and I really wanted to indulge in figuring out, firstly, what played out in this crime, secondly, what she endured during it, but most importantly, how she survived. Because often, when we're discussing crime, we're talking inevitably about people who lost their lives, but today I'm going to talk about somebody who saved her life. So it's Wednesday the 6th of September 2006, and that afternoon, 14-year-old Elizabeth Schoaf, she's better known as Lizzie, so her friends and her family know her as Lizzie, she got off the bus as she did every single day, and she just began her usual walk home. She'd always followed the same routine after school, so she basically walked the 200 yards from her bus stop to her home. And then her normal routine would be that she'd get on with her homework until her parents came back from work. Lizzie lived on Leaning Tree Road in Lugoff, Kershaw County, South Carolina. And this area is a very heavily wooded rural area. It's a rural area near Columbia, the state capital. She lived with her parents. She lived with her younger brother, Donnie, as well. And approximately 4:30 p.m. that day, Lizzie had gone, as she usually did, and walked home part of the way with her school friends. But at this point, her school friends got offered a lift, so somebody came to pick them up. She was offered a lift as well, but she decided that she didn't need to. She didn't have a very long way to get home, so she carried on walking. Now she's on her own, but she's never been scared. She's never been afraid walking home before. She's never had any reason to be. She's ultimately always felt very safe where she lived. But even though she's just going about her daily routine, at this point she has no idea she's being watched. And as she's on that final stretch towards her front door, she's suddenly intercepted. She's confronted by a man who's wearing green cargo pants, he's wearing a green shirt. And what Lizzie is fully unaware of at this moment in time is that he has orchestrated this situation. He'd been waiting for her to get off the bus. Now, this is a man who had lived nearby, but he'd been watching her every single day getting off the bus. He'd been figuring out her habits. And as his fixation and his obsession with this young girl had grown, he decided that he was going to devise a really sinister plan, a plan that she couldn't in her wildest nightmares have imagined was going to play out. The man that I'm talking about was 36-year-old Vincent Villiers. He was firstly an unemployed suspected sex offender, so we're talking about a predator who was living in that community that people genuinely were unaware was there. Police had been trying to track him down for months. He'd previously worked as a builder in construction. He was also known worryingly as a survivalist type, and I say worryingly not because survivalists are not skilled. Of course, it's great to have those kind of skills. The reality is, with a mindset of a predator, a sexual offender, and an individual who is very into survival type lifestyles, well, it offers an opportunity to do things to people at places and in areas that the ordinary person wouldn't either know about or wouldn't feel comfortable going to. This guy could live off the land. He knew the local woodlands really well, and the police had been looking for him because he was wanted at the time by the authorities. He'd allegedly molested a 12-year-old girl, and that had just happened the previous November. So there was this arrest warrant for this criminal sexual misconduct that had been issued, and the police were hunting him down, but they hadn't been able to catch up with him. All the while, this man is literally free in the area that his new victim has been living, completely unaware. Now, Yul-Yor, in that prior attack, he'd woken his victim, who was sleeping in the same bed as a mother at the time. He'd then threatened to hurt her mother if she said anything. At this point, he leads the child to another room and he sexually assaults her. Bear in mind the kind of level of an attack that I've just described there. He's literally removed a child from her sleeping mother. This is an individual who cannot control his needs. This is an individual who sees what he wants and he's going to get it. No matter whether he has to remove a sleeping child from her own parents' bed or otherwise. And even though the authorities know that they have a dangerous predator on the loose, they have absolutely no idea where Vilyor is hiding out. It turns out what he'd managed to do is to construct a system of tunnels beneath woodland near his trailer home. And arguably that suggests that he knows that whilst he's on the run, he needs to make sure that he doesn't get alerted to the authorities. But rather than essentially keep that low profile going, like I said, this is a man who has very poor boundaries, certainly poor consequential thinking, and he can't manage his impulses. So in spite of the fact that he has, to some degree, tried to keep hidden in plain sight, he decides to take another victim, which would obviously blow anybody's cover if they're caught. But it says again that he's an individual who firstly believes that he's able to potentially outsmart authority, or that the cravings that he has as a predator outweigh the rationale of wishing to stay free. It's something that he's willing to take a chance on because he wants to be able to play out these disgusting fantasies and desires that he's harboring daily. Now, the way that Vilyor initially tries to gain Liz's trust is he says he's a police officer. But bear in mind, he's wearing clothes that could to some degree look authoritarian, but one of the things that Lizzie notices is he's wearing a shirt, and on that shirt there appears to be an image of a sheriff's badge on it. It was actually drawn, but in that moment she's trying to very quickly assess whether this man is safe to be around. And certainly we know that when people feel that they're dealing with authority, they act differently. So arguably she has had those natural instincts dampened because she believes, well, maybe this is an officer of the law and I need to respect them and act accordingly. We're brought up in our society to feel that way. It's hard to say no to those situations. A great example of that is the Sarah Everard murder that happened in the UK. That was during the COVID crisis. And a man named Wayne Cousins, who was a police officer, managed to convince her to get into his car. And ultimately, he murdered her. And even though he was a serving police officer, it was clear that he wasn't at that time wearing the clothes. He didn't take her into a marked vehicle. But nonetheless, it was enough for her to believe that saying no would be inappropriate. And again, it's using that vulnerability against people. Certainly for Lizzie, that's what's happening in that moment. So he tells her that he needs to speak to her. So Lizzie's really suspicious, even though she feels like she's got to acknowledge that this could be a person who has something to tell her. She certainly doesn't feel comfortable in his presence. He then tells her that she's under arrest. And he says, the reason that you've been placed under arrest is because there is marijuana in your home. And he also goes on to say, also, we've got your little brother in custody at this moment in time. Now, that creates familiarity. Wait a minute. This man is saying that he's a police officer. Now he's actually introducing me to the reality that he does know that I have a little brother. And that shows that he's been watching her further. But to Lizzie in that moment, it's going to cause a concern. My God, my little brother's been arrested. What on earth is going on? Now, clearly he will have watched her and seen her get on the bus with her brother in the morning. But now we have Lizzie really fearing for her brother's welfare. So because of that, Lizzie goes over and approaches him. She later down the line in interviews said that that was a moment that even while she was walking towards him, she was questioning. She felt like she was making a bad decision. And the minute that she goes up to him, he places handcuffs on her. Then she said he also placed this kind of cable necklace around her neck, and that necklace had this box on the end. And he said to her, this box has got explosives in it, so if you try to escape, I'm gonna detonate it, I'm gonna kill you, and then I'm gonna kill your brother. Now, how on earth you process the amplification of what we're experiencing for Lizzie in that moment? Imagine being in a scenario. You were just about to get home. You can hear the dogs in the distance. This weirdo's approached you, told you this half-baked story about having arrested your brother. You've walked over to him to try to be compliant, to also be caring, and suddenly you're being led into the woods, being told that you have explosives around your neck and that your brother will be murdered unless you comply. Trying to process that must have been absolutely horrifying. So she goes with him and he leads her deep into the woods and walks her around for around an hour. This is all to disorientate her. Actually, in truth, they only end up about a mile from her home, but she feels that she has no awareness of where she is because of the amount of time that they've been walking. And at one point, Lizzie is already being very savvy. She's already thinking about the fact that she wants to escape from this individual, so she drops her shoes because she knows she's in trouble. And she believes that if she just leaves a breadcrumb trail, letting somebody find her shoes, letting somebody know that she is in that area, that could provide a vital clue to the authorities. Villior is also asking her questions whilst he's leading her into the woodland. He says, do you have a phone? He asks her, was she a virgin? Which is a terrifying question to ask a child and is also very indicative of the reasoning behind that child being taken. It's not a question that any adult would ask a child unless they had malevolent beliefs around what they wanted to do with them, in this kind of circumstances at least. And Lizzie starts asking him questions, you know, where are the police? What's happened to my brother? Where is he? And he says, you're a smart girl. You should have figured it out. And then she knows, inescapably, without a shadow of a doubt, she's been kidnapped. She starts crying. She becomes absolutely terrified at this moment and she begs him not to hurt her because she knows there isn't going to be the police, there isn't going to be her brother, she's not being returned to her family. This man has taken her and this man, without a doubt, intends to harm her. It's as simple as that. To her horror, he then leads her to an underground bunker. This is one of several, in fact, that he'd dug in the woodland. It was 15 feet underground beside his trailer. It had a rope ladder, which was made of branches that led down into it. It was 4 feet wide, 20 feet long, and over 7 feet high. It had been carved into the side of a hill. And it is incredible the determination that this man had, because Villior actually dug that manually with a shovel. So his intentions were so driving him that he took part in manual labor of a very high level to achieve his goal of creating these bunkers stroke dungeons. There was actually a piece of plywood on the top of the hole and that acted as a door. And then that was covered with leaves. So obviously it's disguised. Lizzie's watching as he lifts this door and then he takes her down. She was convinced beyond a shadow of a doubt in that moment she was going to be raped and then she was going to be killed. She didn't believe that she was going to survive it. It's evident that Villior had planned to keep her in the bunker for quite a long time. Weeks, if not months, because first of all, it's taken such a long time for him to construct it. You know, he's worked hard on this. There's even a crude hand-dug toilet. There's a makeshift bed. There's shelves that have been made from branches and from canvas. Also present were camping stoves and dishes. And there was even a little system set up to let the smoke out as he cooked. She noticed that all around there is food and clothing. It's stocked. This isn't somebody who's intending to go anywhere. This is somebody who's potentially intending to stay for a long period of time or to keep somebody there for a long period of time. It even had a water supply from a well. Now, she takes in all of this, but also notices some really scary stuff. So there's guns, there's a flare gun, taser, there's even two homemade grenades. I mean, literally, who is this person? When you think about, genuinely, Villiers, think about the mindset of a man who has gone about his business creating this horrific bunker in the ground, but then he's also making dangerous weapons. I mean, this is the kind of human being that can cause catastrophic impact to our society. There is just something deep within them that is so broken, so entitled, so dangerous, that all collides and colludes to create moments like this. She also notices that there are cigarettes and pornography. Again, this is a man taking a child into a bunker. The minute she sees the pornography, she's gonna know this is a guy who has got sexual intentions towards me. And it turns out that Villiers had pornography literally wherever he was, because he was a massive sexual deviant. And no, I'm not saying that people who use pornography are sexual deviants. I'm saying that this individual, wherever he went, literally, there was a trail of pornography with him, because he could not control his impulses at all. Once Villiers has got Lizzie into his bunker, he strips her, which would have been unbelievably terrifying, humiliating, violating. This is a little girl. And this man has taken her, and now he's taken her clothes off, and then he puts a chain around her neck. So now she's a possession. There is nothing more possession orientating than literally being chained by somebody. After he's done that, he violently rapes her. And that would become a very common occurrence during her captivity. So sexual assault was literally constant. That would happen between 2 and 5 times every day. She'd later state, "Whilst being down in the bunker, I was repeatedly raped, threatened, and tortured. I never knew if I was going to live or die, and if I was going to see my family, friends, or my boyfriend again. Day-to-day life was wake up, get assaulted, couple of hours later, if that." So it's just this relentless sexual violation for this child. Villiers always ensured that she had the necklace of homemade explosives around her neck, and he said, should you try to escape, it'll basically explode. He said that he'd rigged the bunker, he'd rigged the entrance with explosives, and that if the police came anywhere near, it'd just be detonated. He made out that there were booby traps all around the environment that he created, including on the outside, so it makes it dangerous for people who might come to rescue her. This feeding her the idea that there is literally no escape. No matter what you do, you'll get hurt, or the people that you love will get hurt. And trying to shift that responsibility and accountability over to her, making her feel like she has to protect people who should be wanting to protect her, that's really troubling, and it's very difficult to manage, because of course she wants to escape, she wants to go home, she loves her family, but she's now concerned that her family might be at threat if they even come looking for her. This whole premise of his action was psychologically to make her scared and to make her compliant. On top of all the horrific abuse and the threats and the constant threat of her life, he also constantly screamed and shouted at her. This is to a young girl who wasn't arguing back. She was doing what he asked. And he's screaming and shouting and scaring her. When Lizzie failed to get home, as she usually did, Lizzie's parents had become really concerned. First of all, she always called her mother Madeline when she got home from school. There was no call that day. And it's instant for Madeline. She just feels like something has to be wrong because this isn't how their life plays out. And I think that if you've got parental intuition, you can connect with that. Sometimes you just know. Something just feels off. It's like the thread that connects you and your child, and you know that something has affected it. And you can't let that feeling go. So Madeline finally calls her son, Donnie, and asks if Lizzie's there. And he says, no, she's not home yet. Madeline immediately leaves work. She then starts calling her daughter's friends, and no one knew where she could be. So after they don't get any joy, essentially, searching around her family and friends, they report her missing later that day. The police, as many of you will be aware, initially were not that concerned. It's weird to me, guys, it's weird to me. I appreciate that there are kids that run away, and I appreciate that the police are busy, but we're talking about a young girl here who's never gone missing in this way before. It's not within her habits. It's not within her behavioural pattern. Her mum and her parents in general are saying, this is not okay, something has gone wrong. And the police are just like, it's just a runaway. It's always what they go for. And it's like, that's vital time. When you think about murders often happening within the first hour, pretty much the first 24 hours being absolutely crucial if you ever want to bring somebody home. Every second, every minute that you buy into this bias that this kid who's never acted this way before has just suddenly legged it from home, it must be so frustrating for the parents and also so debilitating for the investigation, full stop. So they believe that she's just ran away, she's gonna turn up, and because of that, no Amber Alert was issued. So even the community and the wider general public weren't made aware that this child had gone missing. The parents are absolutely devastated. They're really concerned. It's completely out of character. She was a really happy, popular girl. She'd been looking forward to starting high school. She'd even recently started dating a boy. And one of the other things that just stood out as not being funny, Mr. Investigator, Mrs. Investigator, usually they'll take something with them. Nothing of Liz's was missing from the house. It's not like she'd been home and grabbed items that she could have taken away with her that would have been useful. I don't know, a warm coat and a sleeping bag. Or when I was six, I put in my suitcase before I decided to leave home, and it was my mother's small white suitcase. It's very unfashionable. I remember that even at six. I took a dressing gown, not sure how far that would have got me, but I took a dressing gown. Didn't go very far. As I left my house, my mum took it off me and said, you came into this world with nothing, you'll leave it with nothing. It was the quickest return home from running away that I think's probably ever been reported. I think I did 15 minutes at the garden gate and then I went in for my lunch. Anyway, we're not talking about that. We're talking about the fact that even in that circumstance, had I ran away, my mum would have noticed, oh, she's taken a dressing gown. She's serious. But Lizzie's not had anything removed that suggests that she is definitely left home for any purposeful intention. We get to the Thursday, 7th of September 2006. Villiers, he actually makes Lizzie watch the news, which is horrific. He's doing that to torture her. He wants her to see that she is causing pain. Essentially, her absence is causing distress. So she has to sit and watch on this portable, battery-powered TV, people handing out flyers for her, her mother making emotional appeals for her. And in an interview, she talks about the fact that she felt really bad about the fact that her last interaction with her mother had been rude, that it hadn't been some horrific argument, but she just hadn't been very pleasant. And all she wanted when she was seeing her mother make emotional pleas to the public, and boy, were they emotional, she wanted to say sorry to her. She hoped that she'd get a chance to apologise for that last interaction. Villiers showed her every single day on that TV reports about her disappearance. Now that says a few things to us. First of all, this is an individual who likes the acclaim of what he's done. He likes the fact that he's the criminal, he's the perpetrator, he's the kidnapper, and nobody knows it's him. And that feeds that desire for power and domination and outsmarting of authorities, but also it's powerful, it's a torture tool. She knows that these people who adore her and love her and want her home, they are desperate. And she's watching that desperateness, all the while being entirely helpless. The sexual stimulation that pervert who had her would have been getting through watching that and feeling that he was the puppeteer in this circumstance, it's galling to imagine the genuine experience of joy he would have had being stimulated that way. To all of us, it's reprehensible and disgusting, but to him, it's titillating and tantalizing and feeds his sexual dysfunction. The police do start investigating, thank God, because now we're in a situation where she hasn't come home, and they've also started to speak to people who know her. And they're all saying, this doesn't make sense. Lizzie was in a great mood. We had been chatting as normal. She hadn't complained about any problems at home. She'd got off the school bus as normal. She was literally last seen getting off at the usual stop. And her friends had walked with her until they got a lift. So at the end of the day, there was nothing untoward in her behaviour or nothing suggesting that she would have left home. So now, finally, could have been done 24 hours earlier, but you know, we're only talking about a missing child who happens to have been taken by a predator. So like, we are dealing with a situation here where this should have been sorted out from the get-go, because the worst has happened. Yeah, they don't know it yet, but the worst has happened. So now they begin a full-scale search. They've got air support, dozens of neighbours, friends. They also join in. They're all looking for the missing teenager. I am surprised that it turns out the Amber Alert would never actually have been issued for Lizzie anyway. So apparently different states have got different rules on this. And one South Carolina detective later commented they had no reason to issue the Amber Alert, as they had no reason to suspect that she'd left the state. Anybody else figuring out the logic? Sorry? There's no reason to launch an Amber Alert when a kid's gone missing, is likely to have been abducted, and their safety is definitely a risk. Yeah, there's no point. Why? Well, there's no reason to believe that they've left the state. How do you know? How do you even conceive of knowing that? I have no idea. It just makes sense to me. I'm just saying it. You should not be investigating this case. Simple as that. Simple as that. But that's the logic, guys. That's the logic. Even though they had a huge start because they weren't even issuing this as a missing person or a child who was at risk when they initially started talking to the parents, they just said it's a runaway. That person could have gone absolutely out of state. Bear in mind, they've been searching and there was no trace of Lizzie. You could think, well, you've got no leads. Maybe we should start thinking about this being really serious. And unsurprisingly, as time ticks on, yes, the authorities begin to think, okay, she's not coming home. This doesn't make sense. And potentially there has been something very bad that's happened to her. We get to Saturday, the 9th of September, 2006. This is Lizzie's third day of captivity, and I imagine it would have felt endless, endless. And it's here that Lizzie and Villior hear helicopters overhead, so the search is going on, and clearly they're trying to figure out whether there's any bodies that can be seen from the air. But for Lizzie, it also symbolises that hope. These guys are out there, they're taking it seriously, they're looking for me. So she hears the whirring of those helicopters, and then later on she hears footsteps. She could even see shadows of the people searching for her just walking over the hatch. Villior at that moment in time says, if you make a sound, I'm gonna kill you. And understandably, even though we're talking about her life being at risk, she is terrified to actually alert people because she genuinely believes that he is going to kill her. So she remains silent. On one night of her captivity, Bill Yaw's asleep. And at this point, she actually manages to get his gun. She slowly takes it out from where it's positioned. And when she's interviewed about this, you can imagine the tension and anxiety that she was dealing with on an emotional level. And also the absolute heroism, because this is terrifying, guys. The idea of a kid getting a gun and not just managing to get that gun. She then goes over to a sleeping Bill Yaw. She places it against his head and she pulls the trigger. Now, it jammed, which I find a little bit on the frustrating side. I would have liked the story to end here. Lizzie got his gun, held it against his head, pulled the trigger, boom. Then she was freed. We can't do that because that's not what happened. But what is good about this scenario is that he didn't wake up. So even though the gun jammed and obviously she didn't get to kill him, he didn't realise. So that, thank God, didn't lead to her having even worse repercussions than she was already experiencing. So as the days pass, one of the things that Lizzie really starts to recognise is he's not going to let her go. So if he's not going to let her go at this moment in time, she needs to make this situation better for herself. And even though she's very young, she realises that gaining trust and making him feel that she's more at ease in his company, making him believe that to some degree she isn't an unwilling participant in this situation, to try to coax him into almost believing that this relationship that he's forced on her is one that now she's starting to engage in. So she starts to talk to him about things that interest him. And that's important because when you start talking to somebody and engaging with them and building rapport and thinking and talking about things that interest them, that make you seem like a person. You're not a captive. You're not a piece of meat. You're not an animal. They don't own you. You're an independent thinking human being who can relate to that human, who can relate to that individual. Suddenly they see you in a slightly different light. It makes it difficult, at least more difficult, to cause you the harm that they would if they'd seen you only as an object. Then he starts to change his language. He even begins to refer to her as baby, and Lizzie grabs this straight away. She starts calling him baby back, and wow, imagine where you are in this moment. This is a kid. She's gone through the most heinous sexual violations. This man is somebody who's threatened her life on the daily, who's tortured her with visions of all the people who are desperately searching for her. And this is a man who has demeaned her and humiliated her in the most violating of ways, both physically, emotionally, and even familiarly, by taking her to place her in a position where she has to watch her family suffer. These things are grotesque. Psychologically, they're grotesque. Physically, they're grotesque. And she manages, in spite of all of that, to mutter those words, baby, because she knows this is a game psychologically. Don't get me wrong, her circumstances aren't a game at all, but this is a game psychologically and she's going to win. She realises, like chess, you always need to be one step ahead of your opponent, and that's what he is in this situation. He is her opponent and she wants to get the better of him. And whilst he is full of arrogance and narcissism and superiority and entitlement, she has humility. She has grounding. She has a family that love her that she wants to go home to. And she's clever. She's super smart. And she realises that if she can start to build what he believes is a relationship with this man, it's going to be much harder for him to hurt her. He tells her that he loves her at one point. And she says that she loves him as well. She even says that she wants to be with him. She wants to have a relationship with him. She even pretends to enjoy the sexual assaults. And my God, I know a lot of people who come to my channel have been victims of trauma. You've had to survive some of the most traumatizing sexual encounters, and it's been incredibly daunting to do that, and the scars remain many, many years down the line, sometimes eternally. It's impossible for the vast majority of people to pretend that what was going on with the person who was tormenting them sexually is something they could pretend to enjoy. But again, that's what she realizes she needs to do. So she uses his reverse psychology technique on him, and it works. He starts to lower his guard. He starts to open up to her. And also, importantly, it counteracts these attempts that he's had to dehumanize her. And he does stop chaining her at night. Also, the sexual assaults become less violent. Bear in mind, this kind of fits in likely with some of his pornographic material that he's interested in. I imagine he's fantasized about raping a woman and then her enjoying it, because that's some BS material and content that gets played out in those kind of ludicrous films. But it plays into those fantasies. Oh yeah, I was a violent perpetrator. I was this sexual deviant, but actually, my victims really liked it. Now my victim loves me, thus justifying the warped, insane behavior that he's bestowed on this child. He also stops shouting at her constantly, and he even starts letting her out of the bunker for short periods at night with him. It's actually here that he starts showing her the traps and the booby traps that he's made. So it's kind of letting her know what a good captor he is by showing her all these places that he's booby trapped, essentially. But the fact is, he's letting her out. She's done that amount of psychological programming within his psyche that the tables are turning. They're starting to turn little by little. Now, during this time, when she's outside, she'd remove strands of her hair and she'd place them on branches. And the reason for this is she hoped to God that the police would carry on the search and that the police dogs might pick up her scent. So impressive. This is a girl who's realized that she's in a situation where if there's gonna be hope for her, she has to become part of her own saving. She has to become part of providing investigators with the elements that they need to rescue her. And I imagine at the same time, she would want people to know, even if she was never gonna go home, that she had been there. Anything that could lead those individuals to capture the person who in her head had the potential to take her life and may still. She also, during this period, manages to persuade him to actually let her go on his mobile phone so that she can play games. Now, this is very trusting, because the last thing that he wants is for her to be able to contact anyone. The last thing that he wants is for her to be informing authorities where he is and where she is. But again, the incremental trust, she doesn't break it. She just plays games on that mobile phone, and that makes him feel more confident. And this is important, because as more time is passing, the search for her is losing momentum. You're getting less volunteers turning up. You're getting less helicopters, basically fewer people looking. So she knows she needs to do something bodacious to escape this situation. We get to Wednesday, the 13th of September, 2006. This is her seventh day of captivity. Now, whilst Villior is asleep, Lizzie manages to get hold of his phone. At this point, she tries to summon help, and what she does is she writes a text to her mother, Madeline. But bear in mind, she is under a bunker underground. At the end of the day, I can't get reception in my own back garden. That's literally a fact. So we know you're not going to be getting a signal down there. At this point, she doesn't give up. So she tries quietly climbing the ladder to the hatch, and she actually manages to stick the hand beneath the hatch in an attempt to get the signal. She keeps pressing send, but she keeps failing. She's constantly, of course, terrified that Villior's going to wake up, because if that's the case, if he wakes up, he's going to know 100% that this has all been a ruse. She doesn't like him. She doesn't love him. He isn't her babe. This has just all been about manipulating him to get what she wants, and that would play into his rage. And that would likely mean that she'd lose her life. But every night, she keeps trying. And she prays that one day, one message would send. On Friday the 15th of September 2006, 9 days she's been in captivity at this point, Lizzie's mother Madeline's getting ready to attend a vigil for her daughter. She checks her phone. And then she sees a message. She doesn't recognise the number, but she knew it was genuine. And she said to her husband, "Don, it's Lizzie. No one else has my cell phone number." The text read, "Hey Mum, it's Lizzie. I'm in a hole in the ground near Charm Hill, near that dirt road where those big trucks go in and out. Get the police, though be careful. He has bombs hidden." I mean, for Madeline, that moment would be so mixed. This confirmation that firstly, her baby's alive, but that she is in the most precarious and dangerous of situations. She's talking about the fact that she's been kept in a bunker, that there are bombs there. You instantly know your child's life is at risk, and the precarious nature of that situation would be blindsiding and so difficult psychologically to manage. Madeline also knew, just from the information in the text, the area that her daughter was being held. So she immediately informs the police. Now, initially, the sheriff thought the text was a hoax. Probably not a surprise. Probably the same sheriff who was just like, "Oh, at the end of the day, it's just these kids running away, totally out of character, with no reason, taking no belongings, just, you know, 'cause the kids." Probably that sheriff thought it was a hoax. But actually, they were able, when they traced the message, to find it was Villiers' mobile phone. At this point, they speak to a former girlfriend of Villiers, and she confirmed the number. So at this point, like, okay, now we are looking for a known predator who is wanted and whose phone has connected with this woman's phone whose daughter is missing. So the police realise it's an abduction. And at this point, they start establishing which phone masts had transmitted the signal, and they pinpointed the area where they believed Lizzie was being held. And Villiers' former girlfriend even took officers to one of the bunkers that she knew about. So police now realise what they are dealing with. I am unsure, with respect, as to whether the next thing that the authorities did was the right thing to do. You can let me know your thoughts on this. But the authorities made a decision to make public Lizzie's text message, so they identify her abductor. Now, as far as I'm concerned, you have to question the police tactics here. So initially, they don't consider Lizzie's disappearance to be an abduction. It's just a runaway situation, despite the fact that she has no reason to run away and it's completely out of character. Subsequently, there was no Amber Alert issued. The full-scale search is conducted, as we know, but Villiers, a wanted suspected child sex offender, is known to live close to the area that Lizzie's last seen. Even though they've not been able to locate him, you would maybe think that his property would be an immediate focus of attention, just throwing it out there. Then after 9 days, the police absolutely have confirmation that it's an abduction. But this is only because the victim has literally managed to text her own mother after a week of being in captivity and being horribly sexually abused during that. And even then, the sheriff believes initially that the text is a hoax. Now, bear in mind, Villiers is already a wanted man for sexual assault against a 12-year-old. He's evidently a very dangerous sexual predator. And now he's keeping a 14-year-old girl, Lizzie, in the hole in the ground. And yet police, knowing all of this, knowing that she's with an incredibly dangerous predator who, in her own words, has booby traps and bombs and may clearly cause her harm, they then go ahead and decide to make it clear that she's deceived her abductor and summoned help. So yeah, they're like, how could that go wrong? How could it go wrong letting the person who's obviously violent and unhinged and has weapons and has complete control of this child, how could anything go wrong with us letting the world know that she betrayed you and let us know, firstly, that she's obviously there under duress, and secondly, that you're the person who's keeping her? Why would that anger you? It's not going to anger you at all, is it? But that's exactly what they do. So they reveal his identity to the whole nation. To me, that seems like a hell of a risk for the police to take, genuinely. And she actually recounts later down the line seeing the fact that his name is out there in the press. So she knows that he has a strong possibility of realizing that she was the person who did it. And that's absolutely harrowing for her. Villior does soon learn, in fact, that the police are onto him. He hears the helicopters again overhead and he sees news of the manhunt on the portable TV, but also he sees his face, he sees his name, and he's furious. He actually accuses Lizzie at this moment in time of alerting the authorities, but she's clever and she's quick. And she knows that this will seal her fate either way. So she denies it. She says that she loves him, that she'd never do that. And he wants to believe that, remember? He wants to believe that this child that he has abducted and done heinous things to actually cares for him. And that's how narcissistic this human being is. That he is so lacking the actual qualities, the emotions that are required to have relationships of meaning. He's so devoid of those connections that he wants to believe that somehow he has convinced this child that he is the man for her, that he's not really a bad person. Yeah, their relationship started off a little bit on the rocky side, but you know what? It's great now. He wants to believe that. So she just feeds into that ego. Now, she later stated she literally didn't really know what to do at this point. She was scared he was going to kill her. But then she said she noticed that Villior starts to get scared himself. He starts to seem afraid that he's going to get caught. It starts to become real to him. And at this point, bear in mind the fact that she's been psychologically manipulating him for a period of time. Yes, she's definitely the victim in this circumstance, but she's been slowly turning the screws in his psyche, convincing him that she isn't who he thought she would be, that she's becoming what he may want her to be. And now he's looking at her not just as an equal, but as an ally, even as a mentor, a protector. So he turns to his captive and he asks her for help and advice. He says, should I stay or should I leave? Or do I wait it out with you? And Lizzie says, listen, you need to make a run for it. If you get caught, you'll go to jail. And we won't be able to be together if you get caught. I don't want you to get caught. So escape. And he decides in that moment, he's going to take her advice. And as he leaves, Lizzie told him that she loved him. She just cements that connection that he misbelieves exists. You can imagine how she's feeling. This is a child who has been in a bunker for days and days, going through the most horrific experiences of abuse, and suddenly she's outsmarted this man. But she's not sure, has he gone? Has he really gone? So she remains quiet. She thinks maybe he's outside. Maybe this is a test. Maybe this is him ensuring that he knows whether I'm truly telling the truth about my feelings towards him or whether I'm lying because I want to be free. So she decides to wait. She's not going to take any chances. Saturday the 16th of September 2006 is her 10th day of captivity because yes, she waits. She waits. She falls asleep. But when she wakes up, he's not there. Villior isn't present. And now she realises maybe he's gone. So she climbs the ladder to the hatch and she gets herself outside, but when she's there and she stood in the fresh air and she talks about the breeze on her face and the light on her, that feeling, the warmth, she also is terrified that there may be booby traps everywhere. So instead of running off, she just starts to shout for help. And she keeps shouting, but first of all, no one is responding to her. But then she hears somebody shouting back. And the officers that were searching for her finally hear those cries and they discover her just outside of her underground prison. They find, when they discover her, homemade grenades that have been made from pill bottles and gunpowder from fireworks. The first thing that they notice, thank God, is that Lizzie does not seem physically to have been harmed. Of course, they're unaware of what's gone on before. They don't understand at this point that she's had multiple sexual assaults. They take her to Kershaw County Medical Center, and at this point it's about helping her get some space to recover because they want to speak to her. Of course, the detectives want to know exactly what's happened, but essentially they want to give her some space and time so that she can kind of process the horror of what she's been through. She's reunited with her parents later that day. Now, the bunker that she was kept in, they later blew that up because they just wanted no reference that could ever be connected to that horrible crime. And it kind of makes me go, only in America. Only in America would be like, you know what we could do? We could fill this bunker up. We could use earth. Just do what a lot of people do. When a hole, you fill the hole. No, they're like, why fill a hole when you can blow the hole up? Personally, I'm like, I'm not sure that won't create a bigger hole. I don't know. I've never blown anything up. Maybe that's something that I need to have on my bucket list. Now, another ironic twist in this case is that it turns out the police had attempted to serve a warrant and arrest Villiers at his home earlier that week. This was in relation to the November sexual assault. But of course, he'd managed to elude them. And when they went ahead and searched the property, well, they were soon able to discover how he'd retreated into a network of underground tunnels. And that's how he'd escaped. He'd basically made it so that when authorities came for him, he could just disappear. Officers later found entrances to the tunnels beneath his bed, under his trailer, and under a shed. So this is a guy who had been planning to evade capture. Police also found loads of pornographic material. I'm telling you guys, he was obsessed. This is not your normal amount of kind of acceptable material. It was clear that this was an individual fixated on sex. It was in his trailer, it was in his bunkers. They also found night vision goggles. They also recovered the shirt that he was wearing when he abducted Lizzie, and they noticed that he'd drawn the insignia of a sheriff's deputy uniform on it. They also found a handwritten note that was fixed to the front gate for the officers when they arrived, and it read, "Anyone who tries to get past this gate will be shot. No questions asked. This includes cops." Not sure that's like appropriate. I'm sure that there are rules in America that I don't know, but I'm pretty sure that you can't just advise that you're going to kill anyone if they come onto your property. You know, why are there three people dead in your garden, one of whom is a police officer? There is clearly a note on the gate. If they had abided by the rules specified on the note on the gate, they would not be dead. They did what I said they shouldn't. And by the way, I clearly state on said note on gate, no questions asked. Stop asking me questions or you'll be next. But again, superiority, arrogance, entitlement, all playing out in that note. Now, incredibly, this was the second South Carolina case that year involving an abducted teenager who'd been taken to an underground hideout. Yeah, that is right, the second. So on March 14th that year, 48-year-old Kenneth Hinson of Hartsville, he was actually charged with kidnapping two 17-year-old girls. He allegedly abducted them. He took them one at a time to a literal closet-sized dungeon, which he'd basically constructed under his tool shed. Apparently it had taken him 2 years to build. And here he just sexually assaulted them and basically did horrible things to them. Now, ultimately, the girls managed to get themselves free and they were able to walk to safety. And Hinson was captured after a 4-day manhunt. Incredibly, some could say disconcertingly, some could say tragically, he was later found not guilty on all charges at the trial. So he successfully argued that both of the girls had consensual sex with him, which when you look at his picture, I mean, at the end of the day, who wouldn't want to? I mean, look at him. He only looks 20 years older than his 48 years. Sorry, I'm not saying that looks are everything. I'm just saying, these girls, why would they be having sex with this man? So he claims that they basically threatened to accuse him of rape so they could take marijuana from him. I mean, that could happen. It could happen. I'm sure it has happened that false claims have been made. I'm just going to put out there the thing that I think is the fly in the ointment regarding this defense. Specially constructed dungeon. He had a specially constructed dungeon. Like, what planet are we on that he had a specially constructed dungeon where the girls were placed, where they had to escape, and he's saying that was consensual? I mean, what are they saying? Evidently, it's just some kind of vocation that it's got to go and dig in dungeons, as you do. When I'm not digging a dungeon, I don't know whether it's a Tuesday. At the end of the day, it makes no sense. And after the trial, it transpires that Hinson was a sex offender. Yeah, he'd been convicted and spent 9 years in prison. Anyway, that's...
What if I told you that right now, millions of people are living with a debilitating condition that's so misunderstood, many of them don't even know that they have it. That condition is obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD. I'm Dr. Patrick McGrath, the Chief Clinical Officer of NOCD. And in the 25 years I've been treating OCD, I've met so many people who were suffering from the condition in silence, unaware of just what it was. OCD can create overwhelming anxiety and fear around what you value most, make you question your identity, beliefs, and morals, and drive you to perform mentally and physically draining compulsions or rituals. Over my career, I've seen just how devastating OCD can be when it's left untreated. But help is available. That's where NOCD comes in. NOCD is the world's largest virtual therapy provider for obsessive compulsive disorder. Our licensed therapists are trained in exposure and response prevention therapy, a specialized treatment proven to be incredibly effective for OCD. So visit NOCD.com to schedule a free 15-minute call with our team. That's NOCD.com.
Truly another story. I probably shouldn't be telling you about it because I'm definitely going to cover that one at some point. But isn't it great to know that guys who go around, you know, just building the odd dungeon here and there and getting accused of rape by 2 17-year-old girls who tell exactly the same story and identify where the dungeons are, are just allowed to walk free in our society? What's not to be terrified about that? Genuinely, that literally happened. I feel like I digressed a little bit there. Did I digress a little bit there? Just wandering off into some other landscape of criminal behavior, or non-criminal, as the courts may have decided. So now we're at a point when Villiers is on the run and the manhunt is happening. They don't believe at this point he could have got very far. So they've got officers with dogs, they've got police helicopters, they're all scouring the woodland. And at this point, they discover other underground bunkers that Villiers dug. 3 more, in fact, in total. Busy bee. He was a busy bee. I wonder whether he was chatting with the other guy who was building the odd underground dungeon. Maybe a little network of them online. Check the search history. That's all I'm saying. So now they put out a $5,000 reward because they want information that's going to bring this man to justice. He's considered very armed, very dangerous. 17th of September 2006, it's 2 a.m. A woman contacts the police and says, some guy has just attempted to carjack my car outside a pizza restaurant. And she believes that it was Villiers. She recognized his face from the news. And she said that she instantly noticed when he's trying to carjack her that he's got this long knife hanging from his belt. But when he tries to get her car, she's just like, no, genuinely. She was just one of those people who was like, yeah, you're not getting my car. Like, I want your car, I'm carjacking you. It's not happening. I've got a long knife. I don't care. I've got this face. Look, does it look like I'm bothered? Does it look like I'm going to give you the car? Go and carjack somebody else. So arguably, he knows that she's immovable on this position. And even though he's got a knife, he doesn't even use it. Instead, he just starts to run. So police search the area and they apprehend him literally within a few hours. And it turns out that when they catch him, I don't know why I'm laughing. I'm talking about a very serious event, but it's just the fact that this is an individual who thought he was such a survivalist and that he was somebody who could evade capture, but they actually capture him fleeing on foot along Interstate 20 in neighboring Richland County. It's about 5 miles from his trailer and bunker, but he's like literally fleeing on the interstate without shoes on, because that doesn't draw attention to anybody. Totally normal kind of thing to happen. When they apprehended him, he was armed. He had a pellet gun, he had a taser, and he had a long-bladed hunting knife. But he just surrendered. There was no resistance. He didn't try to put up a fight. But the minute that this, shall we say, excuse for a human being, is arrested and confronted with his crimes, he's just like, I did none of it. It's not real. None of that happened. And guess what he said? The truth will come out in the end. Will it? Are we talking about Day of Judgment truth? Are we? Are we talking, Will, you're about your Day of Judgment truth? Because I think it probably will come out, and I'm not imagining it will go the way that you would ideally wish for it to go. So he's basically coming out with all of this BS now about why the crime that he's being accused of isn't actually a crime. Maybe he's been in touch with the other guy who got let off for the fact that he had women in a bunker. You know, at the end of the day, maybe they've already got their excuses lined up. So now he's peddling this story that there is another side to this situation that he hasn't been able to voice. So the thing about America is that in the States, you can do a lot more with people than you can in the UK when they're on trial. So we have some kind of pretty rigorous rules in the UK. That's also why we have people like barristers who wear strange wigs that are ill-fitting and cloaks that look like they come from 1643. We're a bit of a traditionalist kind of nation. So we're still very reticent to let people have information about crimes and even the scenario where you want to get testimonies, you have to go through loops when you want to get the printed testimony of individuals who've been in court. It's really, really hard work. And a lot of times you just get, no, you can't have it. Whereas in the States, it's like, freedom of information request and just give you everything. They're like, here, do you want the evidence as well in the bags? Like, it's great on that level. But it also means that often people get to be interviewed that we would never see interviewed in the UK. And that happens in this case. So just before the trial, Villiers ends up getting interviewed by NBC's Dateline. And wow, it's revealing. Because it demonstrates this terrifying mindset that he had, this warped version of the truth. So first of all, he didn't consider Lizzie to be a victim. Yeah. This is the girl who's been abducted from her home, literally. She just reached home, just about to go and say hi to the dogs, and she was removed by this man against her will, but apparently she's not a victim. No. Been a vacation for her, quote. Like a vacation. They've been having a good time. She didn't have to go to school. They just hung out, you know, as mates do.
Elizabeth, she's, I don't know how to say it, she's pretty much a wild person.
He claimed that she could have gone home anytime.
She could have went home anytime she wanted to.
Anytime she wanted. If Lizzie had just said, I want to go home, I'd have been like, go home, you wild person. I mean, there was literally nothing that was containing her. She was totally at liberty. Didn't you have her chained up with a booby trap around her neck in a bunker? Yeah, I did that. That does not sound very freeing. I think you just don't understand what true freedom feels like. I mean, for anybody listening to this, the ramblings of a man who is in a whole different reality and dimension and universe. But yeah, apparently she could have gone home anytime, even though she was chained up in a booby-trapped bunker. Also, he said, total willing participant. She absolutely was fine the whole time. At the end of the day, she was at peace being in that scenario. So don't get me wrong, bear in mind, Lizzie did an incredible job of duping him, but the idea that he could, from that tiny amount of manipulation where she manages to make him less violent towards her, make that to a scenario where she is complicit in being there, enjoying being there, and that she's just having the time of her life. It's just unbelievable. It shows that he just fantasized about a Stockholm Syndrome scenario, essentially, where his victim had come to love him. But that's what he says. He is out and out the worst type of predator, because he buys into a belief system that nothing that he does is wrong, and everything that he does to his victim is essentially for their benefit, that they truly enjoy it, and that the fact that now it's being protested is less to do with the reality of what occurred and more to do with them not wanting to be seen as somebody who'd willingly gone with this particular individual, in this case, Viljor. I mean, delusional. Beyond belief, delusional. Now, due to the pre-trial publicity, which was obviously huge, but also a little bit increased when the perpetrator was on a TV show, the judge has to move the trial for fairness, nearly 200 miles from Kershaw County, northeast of Columbia, to Beaufort County. That's on the state's southern tip. Now, just before the trial actually commences, Viljor pleads guilty to charges of kidnapping, possession of an incendiary device, and impersonating an officer. That's in addition to 10 counts of criminal sexual conduct. Now, he claims he abducted Lizzie as revenge on the Kershaw County Sheriff's Office. Basically, he said they'd wrongfully accused him of a sex crime. Yes, you did hear me right, guys. I did say that he claims the whole abduction on Lizzie was revenge because he'd been wrongfully accused of a sex crime. So to deal with this wrongful accusation, where most of us, I don't know, we'd be hiring a lawyer, getting a private detective, would be working to clear our name. Most of us wouldn't be like, well, what I'm going to do now? I'm going to go and I'm going to literally commit a sex crime on a completely innocent kid who has nothing to do with this. But that's his logic. To say limited brain cells exist in this man's brain is probably unfair, because I'm not sure there are any. I don't know whether this man is just walking around his life simply with lots of pornographic images and materials going through his head. He's literally killed his brain cells with all of those macabre fantasies that he's created. And it's laughable what he's saying, but when we actually think about what he's done, we're talking about the violation in every shape and form of this child. And yet he believes that somehow he can evidence that he's the victim, that he'd been wrongfully accused. And this is his way of redressing the balance, essentially. We get to the 19th of September, 2007. This is when Viljor is sentenced. Judge G. Thomas Cooper. I do like that name. I instantly feel, oh, we're gonna get a proper American judge now, and they don't tend to go easy on people. You know how it is. Sometimes you'll get a name and you'll be like, I'm not sure they're gonna really go for this punishment-wise. They seem a little bit on the, I don't know, safe side with sentencing. But with a name like Judge G. Thomas Cooper, you think it's gonna be quite a long sentence before we even figure out what that sentence is. And he says the actions were unforgivable. He stated, you have preyed upon a helpless victim with violence and in a savage manner. Now, Lizzie did attend the hearing. She was too emotional to speak. This is an incredible woman, by the way. I can't tell you how watching her interviews inspired me, because she is just so powerful. She is profoundly able to know that she did nothing wrong, to know that none of this is on her. And it's compelling when you see individuals who are not willing to share shame that they do not deserve to carry. Now, even though she can't speak at that because she is so emotional, she has her attorney read a prepared statement. and she asked the judge to make sure that he was sentenced so he couldn't do this to anyone else. So she wants to know that that man is never going to have the opportunity to harm somebody like she's been harmed. The judge rules that the 17 sentences were to run consecutively. He was sentenced to a total of 421 years. That's not a short amount of time, is it? I mean, I don't even know whether people in the Bible get to live that long at times. You know, I think there's a few in there, but like 421 years. You're not getting out, kid. So genuinely, she's got her wish. So he is never going to get out. And he got that 421-year sentence without the possibility of parole. That is the maximum penalty for all the offences under South Carolina law. And the judge, who obviously, I would say, took great pleasure in that moment, he said, "I can think of no crimes short of murder more repulsive than these." Oh, like I said, never get let down when you get a judge's name like that. Now, Villiers' mother, 55-year-old Ginger Nell Cobb, she was actually later charged with helping her son elude the authorities. She helped him to survive in those underground bunkers. Villiers' common-law wife, Cynthia, she was also arrested, and apparently they'd both been providing him with fuel, food, and water whilst he was on the run. And his mother had actually brought the items to Cynthia, and Cynthia would then leave them for Villiers to collect, basically from the abandoned vehicle near his bunkers. So arguably, they are complicit in that way. Now, I'm not saying for one minute that they knew that he had a child in a bunker under the ground. I don't believe that. But what I do know is they knew that he was on the run for a child sex offence. He might have been telling them that he was innocent. Well, go to the authorities and go through legal process, deal with due process. Then when you're found innocent, you can just get on with your life. If you're on the run, it pangs of guilt. Like, no innocent person ever goes on the run. No one goes on the run if they're innocent, because you don't need to. You don't have the mindset where you believe you're gonna get found guilty because you're innocent. And so arguably you would stay within the system and allow due process. When you think about Villiers, he is a very clear paedophile and sexual predator. He's offended before, his 12-year-old victim that he molested, and that offence obviously was more opportunistic, it seems, but his next offence, when he carries out this attack that we talked about today, I mean, that's such a sharp graduation in seriousness. He abducts a young girl, he holds her captive, uses her basically as a sex slave. The extent of the planning was that he planned to keep her there for some time. The bunker must have taken a long time to dig. So he's clearly to some degree an organised offender, because everything must have been meticulously planned. And usually we expect to see organised offenders having a higher IQ than average. But emotionally, many of these individuals haven't got any kind of literacy. So they just don't compute on an emotional level how normal, typical humans compute. And this is undoubtedly, in spite of him potentially having a higher IQ and being very organized and meticulously planning everything, this is why he's outsmarted by his younger victim. This is how she manages to manipulate him, because initially he's fooled by her, claims he's a police officer, that places him in a position of authority in the eyes of a 14-year-old girl. He gains her trust through intimidation so that he can achieve his goal. But then Lizzie fools him. She gains his trust. She can get his mobile phone and play games on it, which is incrementally getting her closer to freedom. What kind of a presence of mind do you have as a 14-year-old child to orchestrate that escape? Isn't it incredible, almost bizarre in fact, that Villiers could pay so much attention to the construction of his crime and yet end up getting caught by a text sent by his victim using his own mobile phone whilst he slept? I mean, fail 101 right there. And it just demonstrates the mental resilience of this child, because she knew The one thing that she wanted was to be able to go home. And she worked hard for that opportunity to create that potential. It's hard.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
Say whether Villiers was ever going to kill Lizzie. On one hand, what we do know is that when he realized that the police were after him and that he had to escape, he could have killed her and he didn't. He could have killed the witness, but instead he left her alive. So maybe it is that he is a horrific predator, but he's not a murderer. But arguably over time, if she had been kept there for a longer period of time, he may have grown tired of the situation and he may have further decided that the best way of avoiding capture was to not allow her to ever be found. And that could have eventuated in a very different story. What we know is that Lizzie survived. And when she was asked about what kept her going, she said that basically she focused on prayer. She focused on her family and going home to them, all the whilst devising a plan to get out. That was always on her mind, that she was gonna find an exit strategy. She never gave up that hope. But even though this is thrilling to some degree, that we're talking about this survival, this resilience, this mental capacity to survive against the odds, we have to remember this was a 14-year-old girl. She was raped as often as 5 times a day. Can you imagine dealing with that for 10 days, the length of time that would have felt, it would have stretched forever. What's incredible about this woman is that following her escape, she just refused to let this ordeal hold her back. She talks about the fact that she's always seen herself as a survivor, not a victim. She's got on with her life, she's graduated college, she became a dental assistant, she's now a mum herself. She's done public speaking, and the whole premise of that is she wants to go out to inspire other people. She wants to help them understand that they can survive tough situations. She also talks to parents about risks to children and how to counter some of those risks. Personally, the thing that I draw from this case more than anything is the police were very lucky in this case. Like, they did everything wrong. Everything wrong. Didn't take it seriously. Didn't acknowledge the realities of what was playing out in front of their eyes. Didn't visit known predators' homes. Thought the text might be a hoax, and so on and so forth. But thank God, in spite of doing everything wrong, it somehow worked out okay. Although, of course, we could never say that what she endured during those 10 days of being in that horrific hole could ever be okay. But what we do have to think is, well, okay, could it have been avoided? You know, if the authorities had recognized that this was an abduction case far sooner, could she have been rescued more quickly? One detective later did admit, we didn't save her. She saved herself. So thankfully, whilst the police did everything wrong, Lizzie did everything right. On 3rd of May 2021, this is 14 years into Villiers' sentence, he was found dead in his prison cell at McCormick Correctional Institution. He was 51 years of age. There was no details that I could find about the cause of death, aside from the fact that they didn't believe any foul play was suspected. He didn't quite make it to his projected release date, unfortunately, of 2,353. Just a few years to go there, didn't he? RIP and all that. Not that I am celebrating an individual's death. I'm just saying that sometime the devil wants those new occupants a little bit early. And as the judge had sentenced him for quite a few centuries, I think he was just like, ah, I'm not going to wait. I'm going to take him now. Today's tale is one that I wanted to share because I've watched the interviews with this young woman. I've seen her resilience. I've even seen the joy that she feels, not because of what she went through, that's obviously horrific, but the joy that she feels, the satisfaction that she outwitted this man who aimed to take everything from her. And in the end, she ensured that she took everything from him. That, to me, is a story worth celebrating, even though it has the horror within it. It's the fact that she became his captor in so many ways in the end. 14-year-old girl.
That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.